listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. The title of James Ellroy's new novel, Perfidia, is borrowed, you heard it tonight, from a Glenn Miller song of the same name, which, Ellroy notes, always takes me back to a time I never experienced, when L.A. had big gleaming cars and there wasn't a particle of smog in the sky. The L.A. you'll encounter in Ellroy's new novel, which opens the day before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, is, in his words, a 24-hour town where nobody was sleeping, everyone was using drugs, taking multiple lovers, people were subsisting off booze and cigarettes. This hard-boiled town of propaganda-fueled racist rampages is shaped, in part, on Ellroy's research into the historical record. As World War II recedes in time, historian John Dower reminds us, it is easy to forget the visceral emotions and sheer race hate that gripped virtually all participants in the war. James Ellroy is an LA native, in his own words, hatched in the film noir epicenter at the height of the film noir era. He's the author of 19 books, including what has become known as the LA Quartet, which includes The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, LA Confidential, and White Jazz, and the Underworld USA trilogy, American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and Blood's a Rover. These seven novels have won numerous awards and were international bestsellers. And his work also includes two acclaimed memoirs, most recently The Hilliker Curse, and before that, My Dark Places, his startling reinvestigation of the unsolved homicide of his mother when he was 10 years old. And we're very delighted to have joining James Ellroy in conversation tonight, Walter Kern, who was here at Aloud this past spring to discuss his marvelous book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade, about his very strange relationship with a con artist who turned out to be a serial imposter and a murderer. Walter is also the author of Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, among other books, both made into major films. Should be a good one tonight. Please join me in welcoming. We'll begin with a reading by James Ellroy. Thank you so much.
Good evening, audience, and thank you for coming. I'm grateful. Walter Kern is grateful. We realized that you had options tonight. You could have stayed home and attended to your drug habits or your sex lives or your neurotic, ungrateful children, but you didn't. You came here to listen to us, and we are nothing but happy for that. You can clap. T.S. Eliot wrote, "In my beginning is my end, and in my end is my beginning." I am going back now in this, the first public appearance for my new novel, Perfidia, to the chronological genesis of my career as a historical novelist. Ross MacDonald wrote, "In the end, I possess my birthplace and am possessed by its language. I only live temporally and physically in 2014. I really live in my mind and in my soul in Los Angeles during World War II, most specifically December 6th to December 29th, 1941, the day before the Pearl Harbor attack, up through the end of the month. I live its music, and you've just heard several haunting selections, and I live its language. It is the vibrato of victory, and it is the vile vituperation of the random racial slur. The Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. There is an entirely understandable but morally unjustified response in Los Angeles that month, and many, many innocent Japanese Americans will pay the price. Perfidia is a 23-day binge. If you read this book, you will be able to sleep with the most stunning movie stars of the era. You will be able to drink titanic quantities of booze and smoke opium in the basement of Kwan's Chinese Pagoda a mile from here in Chinatown. And you'll be able to do it all with impunity. None of you women will have to go to work in a defense plant. None of you men will be shipped off to the Pacific War. These are half a dozen good reasons why you should all buy numerous copies of Perfidia tonight. Perfidia is the first volume of my second L.A. quartet. The original L.A. quartet, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz, was set here in L.A., my smog-bound fatherland, between 1946 and 1958. I followed it up with the Underworld USA trilogy, American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and Blood's a Rover, set in America at large between 58 and 72. The second L.A. quartet draws real-life and fictional characters from the first two extended bodies of work and places them in Los Angeles during World War II as significantly younger people. Perfidia is not a crime novel. Perfidia is not a policier. It is not a mystery. It is not a political novel or a war novel. It is a historical romance. This is a book of deeply held belief, grave conflict, huge geopolitical stakes, and passionate men and women in love. I will read two short excerpts, then I will be honored to join my very close friend, a brilliant, brilliant writer, a luminous American storyteller of my own ilk and out of my own bone and heart. Walter Kern will shoot the shit for the better part of an hour. We will do our level best to entertain each and every one of you, and then you will storm this lectern like the squadrons over Wheeler Field, Schofield Barracks, and Pearl Harbor to buy Perfidia. Reminiscenza. I wandered off in a prairie village 85 years ago. A snowstorm rendered me spellbound then to now. I have outlived the decree and find myself afraid to die. I cannot will cloudbursts the way I once did. I must recollect with yet greater fury. It was a fever then. It remains a fever now. I will not die as long as I live this story. I run to then to buy myself moments now. 23 days, blood libel. A policeman knocks on a young woman's door. Murderer's flags a swirl. 23 days, this storm, reminiscenza. Chapter 2, Kay Lake's Diary, compiled and chronologically inserted by the Los Angeles Police Museum. Los Angeles, Saturday, December 6th, 1941, 11:23 a.m. I have begun this diary on impulse. An extraordinary scene unfolded as I sat on my separate bedroom terrace. I was sketching the southern view and heard the rumble of engines below me on the strip. I immediately got up and wrote down this precise time and date. I sensed what the rumble portended, and I was right. A line of armored vehicles chugged west on Sunset to fevered scrutiny and applause. It took a full 10 minutes for the armada to pass. The noise was loud, the cheers louder. People stopped their cars to get out and salute the young soldiers. It played hell with the flow of traffic, but no one seemed to care. The soldiers were delighted by this display of respect and affection. They waved and blew kisses. A half dozen waitresses from Dave's Blue Room ran out and passed them cases of liquor. Somebody shouted, "America!" And that's when I knew. The war is coming. I'm going to enlist. I always do what I say I'm going to do. I formally state my intent and proceed from that point. I am going to write a diary entry every day until the present world conflict concludes or the world blows up. I will walk away from my easy existence and seek official postings near the front lines. I live a dilettante's life now. My compulsive sketch artistry is a schoolgirl's attempt to capture confounding realities. My piano studies and emerging proficiency with the easier Chopin nocturnes stall my pursuit of a true cause. This lovely home in no way allays my psychic discomfort. Lee Blanchard's indulgence is disconcerting more than anything else. This diary is a broadside against stasis and unrest. I have always felt superior to my surroundings. This house states that case most tellingly. I picked out every German expressionist print and every stick of blonde wood furniture. I'm a prairie girl from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and a gifted Aravist. I'm moving into my separate bedroom now. My own work is arrogantly displayed on the walls, interspersed with Clay and Kandinsky. There are a dozen drawings of a light heavyweight named Bucky Bleichert. He has a hungry young man's body and large buck teeth. I have sketched him many times from ringside seats at the Olympic. Bucky Bleichert is a local celebrity who understands the ephemeral quality of celebrity and does not view boxing as his true cause. His circumspection in the ring delights me. I have never spoken to Bucky Bleichert, but I am certain that I understand him because I was a local celebrity once. It was February of 39. I was 19. It all pertained to a bank robbery and its alleged solution. This house, a refuge a few years ago, a trap now. The robbery got me this house, not Lee's prudently invested fight winnings. Lee Blanchard is not a savvy investor, as is commonly held. Nor is he my lover in the common sense. He entered my life to facilitate my destiny, whatever that is. I know it now. Sioux Falls was an insufficient destiny. The winter cold spells and summer heat waves left people dead. Indians strayed from nearby reservations and stabbed one another in speakeasies. Klansmen broke a Negro man out of the county jail. He was accused of raping a dim-witted white girl. The Klansmen convened a kangaroo court. The girl was slow to condemn or exonerate the man accused. The Klansmen staked him over a red anthill in mid-August. The summer sun, or the ants, killed him. Local lore was divided on this. Protestants despised the few local Catholics. Nativist groups flourished throughout the Depression. Methodists were at odds with Lutherans and Baptists and vice versa. A range war over prize cattle broke out in 34. 14 men were killed near the Iowa border. My parents and older brother were sweet-natured and content. Their only sin was lack of imagination. I pretended to be one of them in order to live within myself unobstructed. I lived to read, draw, and roam. People talked about me. I read Tracy bon mots in church. I did not care about my family. That fact mildly horrified me. I wanted to run away to Los Angeles and become someone else here. I got a job at a bookstore and stole a month's work of cash receipts. I left my parents a perfunctory note of farewell. It was November of 36. The bus ride west featured dust storms and a flash flood near Albuquerque. Armed goons were stationed at the California border. They were charged to keep indigent Okies out. They were moonlighting LA policemen. That armored convoy passed out of range. I watched it go. That rumble has now left my body. Nothing before this moment exists. The war is coming. I'm going to enlist. Ladies and gentlemen, my good friend, the great Walter Kern.
We're an advertisement for Brooks Brothers tonight. Well, James, okay.
Hey, brother, what's up?
I can't imagine being more privileged in a literary sense than to sit at ground zero for the first night of the first book in the first, though it's the second, L.A. Quartet, in the very spot, really, where it begins and takes place. I mean, near the very geographical spot. What was this place like that night before Pearl Harbor? What was this city when the moment before you strike the match that lights it aflame?
Saturday, December 6, 1941, was cool. It was clear. The night turned chilly. City Hall was lit up, as it always was. By civil code, it was the tallest building in Los Angeles. It adjoined Chinatown. It adjoined Little Tokyo. The LAPD Detective Bureau was there on the premises. The LAPD's traffic division was over at 3rd and Figueroa, just a few blocks from here. The hero of Perfidia, William H. Parker, who would go on to become LAPD's great reforming chief, was a captain then and ran traffic division. It's a localized, small town trying its damnedest and its hardest to become a big city, and the war hits. And ground zero in Los Angeles is this conjunction of racial bias, official jurisprudence with LAPD and the Hall of Justice and city government. The Chinese hate the Japanese, and Chinatown and J-Town sit adjacent. The LAPD crime lab, where a young forensic chemist named Hideo Ishida, the only Japanese working for LAPD at the time, toils, is just a few blocks away from where we sit now. Dudley Smith, the ultimate villain of the first LA quartet, is a young homicide detective. He will be called out because there are bodies in a house off the Arroyo Seco Parkway, which was just completed in 1940, and the squawk takes him and Lee Blanchard to Avenue 45.
Okay. You know,
you're all thinking, that's a travelogue, Pops.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to play the role of feeding this guy. I'm not going to try to. So those bombs drop out in the Pacific. And I was thinking and reflecting just tonight that this was only the only real major city in America that actually had something physical to fear, perhaps. We could have been next here in L.A. I mean, your book starts with blackouts, with roundups, with, you know, true terror. Describe the sense of sort of fear and adrenaline that seized this city when Pearl Harbor took place.
We got the news of the bombings at 11:30 a.m. The enlistment line downtown here at the federal building swelled to 2,000 within an hour and a half. The feds, the L.A. sheriffs, and LAPD had compiled lists of alleged subversive Japanese-born Japanese and Japanese-Americans. They immediately descended on Little Tokyo and began rounding up deemed subversives, some subversives, largely innocent and wrongly accused subversives. Racial hate against the Japanese swept the city almost overnight. The Chinese Americans, the Chinese-born Chinese, inhabited Chinatown just a few blocks due north of Little Tokyo. It was a great recipe for big fear, bad juju, fabulous fistfights, an egalitarian level of the playing field where rogue cops could all of a sudden have affairs with the likes of Joan Crawford and Betty Davis, and you'll get inside views of this shit in this novel of mine.
See, James is one of these authors who sleeps with his co-stars. He sleeps with his characters. So before you, before you get to read about them, he's probed every nook and cranny of their. How is this downtown, racially charged city of, L.A., related to that other place, Hollywood, at the time this happened? I mean, how did they interact? What was the sort of balance of power between them? What was their relationship?
You had the corrupt chief, Clements B., call me Jack Rowell. He was a Hollywood toady. The studios had their own police forces, their own goon squads, their own strike breakers, and their own abortionists. It was very much a company town run by the PD, run by Mayor Fletch Bowron, run by the Merchant and Manufacturers Association, and run by Hollywood moguls.
And in your book, you describe a sort of patriotic fervor that grips the city.
Yeah.
You know, there's both a sort of racial element to it, but there's also a deeply idealistic red, white, and blue, moment of sort of idealism. What was America like in the prism of LA at that moment? I mean, were we gonna avenge fascism? What were we gonna do? I mean,
they fucked with us, and so we were gonna fuck with them, and toot fucking sweet, and God bless us for that resolve. And Admiral Yamamoto said that very fateful day of December 7th, 1941, what I fear we've done is to awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve. But as someone says in the great Australian TV show, Blue Murder, the green light was not all beer and Skittles, hence the Japanese internment. And guess what? You can have great, great patriotic fervor coming from a deep moral place and have endemic racial bias sitting two steps away from it and concurrently, and dare I say it's all in this book.
Right. So you can have a noble cause on top of an ugly reality. I've read review after review of this book, and the cleverest things a lot of these reviewers managed to say is there are no heroes in James Ellroy's. There are there's no wonder world. There's no good guys. There's no moral difference. Are there no good guys in your books? Is everybody just morally corrupt and, you know, fighting it out in a Hobbesian jungle? Or
no. Perfidia is a tender novel. It is deeply about belief. It was a time of right-headed belief, wrong-headed belief, and outlandish belief. It's the story of populism gone bad. Socialism and leftist fascism and rightist fascism on the rise, but only compared to Europe, the Orient, and Russia to small, small dimensions. Race baiters like Father Coughlin, the big Catholic race baiter, Gerald L. K. Smith, the big Protestant race baiter, started out in the early 1930s as share-the-wealth socialists. And they saw in capitalist America circa 1934 that there was only one going Western socialist republic, and it was National Socialist Deutschland. Hitler gave good-looking Aryan women breeding bonuses. He put people to work and rebuilt the roads. He gave everybody the month of August off, and along with it, and on the backs of mad eugenic philosophy and his devastatingly vile persecution of German Jews. It was all linked together in the potpourri that was geopolitical reality up to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. People believed in the craziest shit. They believed that the Jews engineered the war. This vile anti-Semitism was petulantly, peevishly, and invasively discussed on the radio and every day on the floor of the United States Senate. You look back and you think, how could people believe this crazy shit? A Filipino man at the height of the December roundups heard a song on the radio called Johnny the Jap Killer. So he went out and stabbed a Japanese man to death. But alas, the man wasn't Japanese, he was Chinese. This is Los Angeles in 1941. Rogue cops, with Betty Davis, and it's not all bad. The world's greatest parties, because those swabbies at Pearl Harbor didn't know what hit them, and we could be next. And along with that, the Japanese internment and this horrible anecdote I just described.
So you've got this city. It's riven racially. It's got fascist sympathizers. It's got sympathizers with the imperial Japanese cause. But it's a patchwork incendiary about to go off. And there's this man, future LAPD chief, William H. Parker, from Deadwood, South Dakota.
Yeah.
Truly from Deadwood, South Dakota,
yeah.
Who's come to town. And he's not Marshall Dillon yet, but in your book, he starts to emerge as a force for what? I mean, it's almost as though your book is the chronicle of the beginning of civilization in Los Angeles.
William H. Parker was a devout Roman Catholic, and in many ways to the Protestant Elroy, he was no less than Luther. I have been served with a piece of paper. Let me tell you about it. It comes to me from a latrine called Rome, that seat of the devil's own sweet empire, and claims to excommunicate me, Dr. Martin Luther. I have spoken with God, and he has told me there can be no deals with Rome. And as for this piece of paper, it is going to burn in hell, and so are the balls of the Medicis. That's William H. Parker. An intemperate alcoholic, guilt-driven, lusting for young women, such as Kay Lake, whose diary I just read from, overweeningly ambitious, corrosively ambitious, horrified at his own moral disengagement and the vile things that he, the pious reformer, did under the reign of the roundly corrupt former chief James Edgar Two Gun Davis. The Watanabe murder case, what may or may not be happening with Kay Lake, his bitter, acrimonious relationship with Dudley Smith, and the Japanese internment itself will set the stage for the ultimate redemption, ambiguous in nature, of the city of Los Angeles itself in this great book of mine, which is my ragtime.
At approximately four times the length, and I'd say 10 times the excitement, Frank. But that's just my opinion. Now, let's talk about women for a minute.
Yeah.
Kay Lake, you described her coming, you know, out of the dusty Midwest.
Yeah.
Parker himself is a character out of the Midwest. And she is the only person in this book who gets to speak in the first person.
Yes.
She gets to speak for herself. We get to go inside her heart and her head in a way that we don't with everybody else. Who is she, and what kind of yearning does she bring to this situation? I mean, is she the ingenue in town? You know, who is this mystery woman? Where does she come from in James Elroy's mind?
Kay Lake is the heroine of my latter set, but earlier written novel, the first in the L.A. Quartet, The Black Dahlia. In The Black Dahlia, she ultimately marries Bucky Bleichert, the boxer that she has a crush on in the unfolding pages of Perfidia. But I attribute no interior monologue to her in The Black Dahlia. Thus, the events of Perfidia are what she has hidden from her husband, ultimately, Bucky Bleichert, and the world at large. She is my adventuress, my huntress. She is the object of my own unfulfilled yearning. She is women out of my personal past. She is a woman I glimpsed in a photograph taken on Wilshire Boulevard, VJ Day, August 1945. I have thought of that woman and prayed for that woman for over 55 years. Perfidia is a historical romance. She embodies belief, and she embodies in her courage, in her grit, in her madcap wit, in her outsized sexual appetite, in her patriotism, in her mordant critique of 1941 America, she embodies the great American woman.
You know, anybody who thinks women are chaste wallflowers who are inherently virtuous should not read this book. Because Kay's counterpart in huge erotic appetites is Bette Davis, the film star, as we've never seen her before. You have her selling war bonds. You have her out there, you know, sort of at the hustings, whipping up, you know, support for the war effort. Who is Bette Davis, and how does she function in this scheme of, you know, larger than life characters?
To begin with, she was Bette Davis. To begin with, she's best taken in small doses, which is why there's only 7 scenes with her in this book.
As she steals every one of them, though.
She steals every scene that she's in, as was her wont. She loved the common folk in extremely small doses because they were her ultimate audience and they made her feel authentic. She's a bigger character than Joan Crawford, who, frankly, I went for more and liked more as an actress. But Joan Crawford, whatever her strengths, was not Bette Davis.
Now, in this book, there is, as you've already given away, because there's not much that I want to give away here, this plot is as tightly woven as a majestic Oriental rug. You pull one thread of the design and the whole thing, you know, changes and moves. And I really am not wanting to spoil anything for you. But Bette does have a love affair with policemen in this book. Is that plausible? Is James Ellroy just running through history, amusing himself at the expense of the facts? are we witnessing here truly the secret radical history of L.A., or what we witnessing more like the midnight visionary hallucinations of a madman?
The answer to that, my dear friend, is both. And fiction to me is an exercise in benign megalomania. I get to bomb Pearl Harbor and intern the Japanese and pour the pork to Bette Davis and murder the Watanabe family and indulge all my appetites. And believe me, I have them. And nobody, least of all me, gets hurt. It comes down to this. Verisimilitude, is it plausible within historical context? This war, the month of December 1941, it is the primer on egalitarianism and inclusion that we should all study today for its positive effects, for its deleterious effects, and as you commented to me, Walter, it was one big binge. There's Ben Siegel, Bugsy Siegel's Get Out of Jail Party with all kinds of movie stars, Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., Bette Davis, the cops in this book, prostitutes, and on-duty Marines. And there's bobbing for apples and rum punch and lots of weed and lots of dope and lots of wanka-wanka going on, and with a complete disregard for social strata. And that's not all bad. There's that party at Ace Kwan's Chinese Pagoda's basement with the opium den down there and Clark Gable making the scene with Salvador Dali's Pet Leopard and Count Basie and his orchestra and Archbishop J.J. Cantwell, the big cheese at the L.A. Archdiocese. It was a rockin' time. There's two great party scenes at the home of a leftist socialite named Claire de Haven that Kay Lake narrates.
Walk-ons from Bertolt Brecht, Rachmaninoff, Paul Robeson.
Paul Robeson. Leonard Bernstein plays the piano with Kay Lake. You got to read this book. What are you going to do?
Well, you know.
Go home and turn on a rerun of some BBC show? No.
You see, when I came in here, I was prepared with a zinger that you diffused by calling your own book a romance novel. Mm-hmm. Not a romance novel, but a historical romance. I was going to call it a romance novel as a sort of, you know, I was going to call you Barbara Cartland with blood. But it is a book about passion, about love. It's a lot of fun. What was it about this time that you know made it so large that you had to start the story here? I mean, this is, you could have picked any moment, you could have picked any, you know, big bang for your magisterial, now 11-part book. I mean, 8-part LA quartet plus 3 American parts thrown in. Why did you pick this, and what is it that held in suspension all that was to come in this moment?
I have voluntarily lived in history since I was a small boy. I have always grasped for imaginary threads to explicate the Los Angeles and America before the time of my cognizance. I wrote my post-war quartet. I wrote my 50s into the 70s trilogy. And I wanted to go back and to unify my entire career as a historical novelist and make it one seamless, dense, emotionally and physically coherent whole. I wanted to tell the story of a single great injustice, the Japanese internment, and begin with the Big Bang of America's entrance into World War II with these previously exposited, previously etched characters of mine as much younger people. And in World War II, this ghastly, enormous canvas, the largest event in world history, I have finally found a happening large enough to sate my literary megalomania. I'm surprised it took this long.
So what you're saying is you want to take modern history and the story that we all have received about what happened and who the big players were and replace it with your own invented,
yes,
fanciful. Mm-hmm.
Verisimilitude, Walter, the semblance of truth. If you read it, if you believe it, then you are part of my grand design. The grand design of my career is to create for all of you, my beloved readers, the secret human infrastructure of large public events. For every enormous event, World War II, the Japanese internment, the attack on Pearl Harbor, the deportation of the Japanese to the camps up the coast and in the American heartland. For each and every one of those large, multifaceted, oft-scrutinized events, there are 40,000 individual stories. I want to connect it all for you in the form that is the true great love of my life, and that's the novel.
So it's James Ellroy's world. We all just play small extra parts in it, and, you know.
Shit. Walter, you know, you live in it for the length of time it takes you to read Perfidia and the seven novels that comprise the L.A. Quartet and the Underworld USA Trilogy. And in the meantime, you got your sex lives, you got your drug habits, you got your jobs, you got your professions, you got your unruly and ungrateful kids, you got your mortgages. It's fucking hot in L.A.
Right.
Yeah. Well, your life.
You know, this is the only man who doesn't know that a new iPhone was introduced today. The only man in Los Angeles. James, I happen to know, is unreachable by any electronic modern means. What is it about this world that causes you to prefer to live in that world? In other words, you've talked about your love of the past. Yeah. Let's just talk, before we go to the audience, about the present. What have we lost? What is there in this romance that you yearn for and feel the lack of, perhaps, nowadays?
I did not first run to history as the result of any perceived disengagement of my present as a 7 and 8 year old in mid-1950s America. I just got hooked like it was big age. And I've always lived within my imagination. I'm having a blast living in LA right now, America, and the world right now. But in order to write the books I write, I live a life of period immersion. Let me preempt a couple of potential questions right now. Perfidia has nothing to do with America or world politics today. If you want to draw conclusions and if you want to draw relevance to today's world, please do so on your own dime. I ignore the world today. I listen to the music of the 70s, and not the 1970s, I mean the 1870s, when Brahms, Liszt, and Wagner were in full flower. I got lucky very early on. I figured there's 6 or 7 things that jazz me, and right at the heart of it is history.
You know, before we go to the audience, I want to throw out my sort of best and most profound insight into the work of James Ellroy. Because, I mean, for as much as he's a casual guy who speaks in the vernacular, I think you're looking at the Faulkner of Los Angeles. You know, you're looking at somebody who has really dug deep into the soul of a place, had the highest ambitions, executed them to the nth degree and to the full extent of his powers, which are, you know, enormous. And he's an artist of the greatest significance. I saw a quote from you in the Daily Telegraph, a British newspaper, about the book. You were explaining the relations between various characters in your books, and you made the remark that I think it might be surprising to some of your fans, because maybe you're thought of as a rabble-rouser, a guy who traffics in, you know, a sort of anachronistic racial and ethnic portrait of the world. You said, "We're all one soul." And when I look at James Ellroy's work, I see the struggle of individuals in different colored skins and different gendered packages to come together after this agonizing spiritual separation that we experience when we come into this world. What is the spiritual content, message, and drive behind your work? Because only a spiritual motive could power thousands of pages of the most serious and ambitious fiction. Where's it really coming from? Besides your love of hanging out with Bette Davis and crooked cops and, you know.
God has been very kind to me. I've been blessed with some talent and a sturdy heart and ambition enough for any 30 people on the face of the earth. And I have an astonishing appetite for hard work. I love to work. And I'm a happy egg. And these books underneath it all express joy, the outrageousness and the outrageous joy I take in all forms of language. Black hipster talk, junkie jive, Yiddish, racial invective, alliteration is astonishing. I love language, hence the Ross McDonald quote at the beginning of my remarks here. In the end, I possess my birthplace and am possessed by its language. I am fueled by a kid's desire to manifest in the world for primarily my own enjoyment, but for all of you as well, what I loved most as a child, and that was reading. I loved to read. I inhabited this library. I did my first informal research into the Black Dahlia murder case in newspaper microfilm archives 50 yards from where we're all sitting right now. I am driven by a desire to serve God, to touch people in my glancing, oddly impersonal, oddly personal, ephemeral way, with all the beauty and horror, goodness, generosity, rage, sexuality, and tenderness that I still feel within myself and that still threatens to overcome me when I can't fall asleep at 3 o'clock in the fucking morning.
Period. Oh,
period. Yeah.
That there was a period there is amazing. You're supposed to be a writer of short sentences. Huh. Well, we're going to go to the audience here. They're going to pass around a microphone. And
hey, again.
Yo, what's shaking?
I have a question for you. At least for me, one of your most haunting characters, I wish you could elaborate, tell us what makes him tick. Uh-huh. None other than Sergeant Dudley Smith.
Boss, you haven't read Perfidia yet, have you?
No.
You're about to find out. Think up another question, less specific, more metaphysical, so I can impress this audience with the new, thoughtful, spiritually defined Elroy.
You talk about Betty Davis, you talk about Parker, but for me, Dudley Smith is the one that jazzes me when he appears in your books. You know, it's like, oh, nobody puts the bookmark in their books when Dudley Smith enters, let's say.
God bless you. He's the hero of this book, or the anti-hero. Your call.
I had an intelligent metaphysical question, but I'm not going to ask it. I wondered where in L.A. you grew up and whether you went to J.B. or Bancroft.
I grew up around Beverly and Western. I went to J.B. Did you go there?
I went to Bancroft and Fairfax.
I went to Fairfax, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 4 years before I did, so we just missed each other.
Brother.
Hi. When one of your novels like L.A. Confidential gets made into a film, do you prefer to not see it because it may conflict with your own imagination, or do you actually enjoy checking it out?
Money is the gift that no one ever returns. The color green is always flattering, and the size large always fits. L.A. Confidential is a marvelous movie. It's only 15% of the story. If you haven't read the book, I would urge you to. After you read Perfidia.
Hey, quick question. I've always kind of noticed with your novels, you reflect on a period in America that people kind of glorify, and they've always kind of looked at it as the golden age of America where nothing bad happened. But you kind of bring the light to a lot of the more terrible things that we kind of did see during that time period. And I was always curious, was that your intention to kind of just go over the period as a whole and say to yourself, okay, this was a great period, but it had its dark moments, and everybody needs to come to realize that as well?
I have no soapbox in that regard. I want to live the period that I write. I am interested in immersion. I am interested in inhabiting it and living a diverse range of lives indigenous to the time. Whatever you pull thematically, socially, politically, spiritually from these stories, morally, chiefly, that's up to you. I'm not out to blow the lid off of anything.
Can you talk about, when you're embarking on this new series of books, if you find it limiting or perhaps freeing to work with a set of characters that, as an audience, we know will largely make it to the next?
It's liberating in that the final design is to create a coherent 11-book whole, and one that's entirely seamless, one that will ultimately be read in strict chronological order. And I have missed them, and I wanted to live their lives again.
Should we read Perfidia first if we haven't read the others?
Emphatically read Perfidia first. For one thing, it's my current book. Secondly, it will revitalize and dramatically revise your relationship to other books of mine that you may have already read. To be able to see William H. Parker, Bucky Blickert, Lee Blanchard, Dudley Smith, Kay Lake, numerous others, in context, seamlessly in 1941, will enhance your enjoyment and your acuity when you read The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, like Confidential and White Jazz.
Hi. All of your characters have intelligence, but this quartet of characters in Perfidia, they're all almost self-consciously intellectuals. They're not Bud White. Kay Smith is an intellectual. Ashita, Dudley Smith in his own sort of radically evil way. And Parker is a reformist. Is there anything to that? And is that part of the design, self-consciousness?
Oh, yes. It's very, first of all, it's an excellent perception. And since you've obviously read the book, probably an advanced reading copy that you got over the portal somehow, I would encourage you to buy multiple hardcovers after this event. Yes, they are brilliant, brilliant men and women. Each one of them, Hideo Ishida, the forensic chemist, the evil cop Dudley Smith, the great lawyer policeman William H. Parker, and the brilliant madcap, roundly heroic diarist Kay Lake. Yes, they're all geniuses. And as one of them ruminates near the end of the book, we were as one and bound by a terrible allegiance in the time of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, two quick questions. One is, I heard you allude to supporters of Imperial Japan, mm-hmm. and maybe I've just taken classes that skipped over it, but my recollection in studies is that there was never anyone that was ever found to be a traitor to the U.S. So I'm.
There were no sedition trials in the United States. The Japanese internment was surely from the ground up unjust. There were no acts of sabotage ever perpetrated by Japanese-born or Japanese-Americans, which I say in this book.
Right.
It is safe to say, though, with the aggregation of Japanese in California at that time, there were some supporters of Imperial Japan.
Secondly, I'm just wondering if in this book you bring in anything about Jewish Americans who had a foothold here also in Los Angeles and in Hollywood, and the varying feelings they had about the U.S.'s not joining the cause earlier and now being thrust into it.
It's all in here. The pervasiveness, yeah, the pervasiveness of anti-Semitism in America and America's dragging its heels until the attack on Pearl Harbor before it entered the war. And there's Winston Churchill's great quote, "You can trust America to do the right thing after it's tried everything else." Yeah.
Last question right here.
The last question, oh my Lord. I may be the only person in this room that has not read your work.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to have a field day haranguing me to get all of your books. But watching you and hearing you, you are so fascinating. This is the antithesis of metaphysical. You are so controlled with everything that you do, your speech, the way you answer a question the way you want, regardless of what the question is. It's really fascinating to watch. But you also have this undercurrent, this kind of junky, funky guy. And I'm listening to you talk, and so precise and so controlled, I have to ask, I'm wondering what you're like in bed. I mean, are you messy? Are you loose? Don't tell me it's in the book, please.
There's only one way to find out, I guess.
I have a memoir that was published and in 2010. It's called The Hilliker Curse. Hilliker was my mother's maiden name. It's subtitled My Pursuit of Women, and it's not a terribly explicit memoir because I'm such a deep and sensitive Lutheran guy, but there are copies that will be on on sale here afterwards to supplant your copies of Perfidia, The Black Day, The Big Noir, L.A. Confidential, White Jazz, American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and Bloods Are Over.
Let's bring this tone back up just for one last question.
Walter's got a question.
James, why do you write? Why do you do it? Why? I think you answered it before in some way, but I really need one I can put in a notebook.
In my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light, not for the strut and trade of charms upon the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart do I write on these spindrift pages, but for the lovers, their arms round the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my art or craft. Dylan Thomas. This was fun.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.